On March 13, 2024, national polygamy advocate Mark Henkel shares SCOTUS decision, Reynolds v. United States of 1878, Part 5. Hello, friends, supporters, listeners, and sharers. Imagine a world where your wife or husband, against their will, could be compelled to testify against you for marrying you. For polygamists, that world is not imaginary. It is very real indeed. As per the recap 123 from the previous episode of this podcast, we have already delved into the first three of the six questions that the U.S. Supreme Court addressed in the case of Reynolds v. United States of 1878. For any listeners hearing any of this for the first time, I would encourage you to go back and listen to both that and the earlier previous episodes in order to help you bring yourself up to speed about this case. This episode here now, episode number 313 of March 13, 2024, will focus on the fourth question of the six questions, question number four. That question number four asked, quote, four, was the testimony of Amelia Jane Schofield given at a former trial for the same offense, but under another indictment, improperly admitted in evidence? Unquote. Let's first note that this woman's name is spelled S-C-H-O-F-I-E-L-D. Sometimes the S-C-H could be pronounced as S-H, as in Schofield. Other times, S-C-H could be pronounced as S-K, as in Schofield. I have found myself sometimes pronouncing it the first way, Schofield, and other times pronouncing it the second way, Schofield. I do not know how that woman herself pronounced it, although it seems likely that it was most likely the S-C-H in the word school, Schofield. One thing I know for which I can be more sure, I surely doubt it was ever pronounced Schofield. Anyway, for this episode, I will pronounce it as Schofield, like the S-C-H in school. Now that we have that so important info out of the way, let's dig in, shall we? The woman's first name was Amelia, and she was reportedly the second wife of the defendant, George Reynolds. She had already been required to testify under oath during a separate indictment against defendant George Reynolds. Citing the text of the case itself, quote, after the trial commenced, the district attorney, after proving that the defendant had been married on a certain day to Mary Ann Tuddenham, offered to prove his subsequent marriage to one Amelia Jane Schofield during the lifetime of said Mary. He thereupon called one Pratt, the deputy marshal, and showed him a subpoena for witnesses in this case, and among other names thereon was the name of Mary Jane Schobald, but no such name as Amelia Jane Schofield. He testified that this subpoena was placed in his hands to be served. Unquote. To clarify, Mary Ann was purportedly the first wife. Amelia Jane was purportedly the second. The initial subpoena was supposed to have been served to the purportedly second wife, Amelia Jane. But the name written on that initial subpoena had instead only used the first name of the first wife, Mary Ann, then used the correct middle name, Jane, and finally also misspelled the actual last name as S-C-H-O-B-O-L-D, Schobald, instead of Schofield. When the deputy marshal attempted to serve this initial subpoena, defendant Reynolds denied that she was there. A corrected subpoena with the correct name on it for Amelia Jane Schofield, was issued that same evening. The deputy marshal attempted to serve the corrected subpoena the next day. From the transcript, the deputy marshal testified that defendant George Reynolds, quote, said that she was not in, and that I could get a search warrant if I wanted to search the house. I said, will you tell me where she is? He said, no, that will be for you to find out. He said, just as I was leaving the house, don't remember exactly what it was, but my best recollection is that he said she would not appear in this case. Unquote. Consequently, Amelia Jane Schofield, or Schofield in whichever way is pronounced, Amelia Jane Schofield did not get served, and thus she did not personally testify in this case for this indictment. For context, all listeners should contemplate the horror of a wife being compelled by subpoena to testify against her own husband. If government decided to expand its tyrannical, anti-constitutional marriage control to one day also criminalize even the marriage of OMOW, O-M-O-W, one man, one woman, or even to recriminalize the recently added form called same-sex marriage, I have no doubt that even the most adamantly hostile anti-polygamist would also have done the very same things, just as the Reynolds family had done when faced with the possibilities of being served these subpoenas. Indeed, it is horrific to any rational or compassionate mind to even contemplate or think that our own government could be this tyrannical as to actually compel a wife to testify against her own husband for simply marrying each other. So what did the prosecution do instead? Citing the Supreme Court's decision, quote, the district attorney then offered to prove what Amelia Jane Schofield had testified to on a trial of another indictment, charging the prisoner with bigamy in marrying her, to which the prisoner objected on the ground that a sufficient foundation had not been laid for the introduction of the evidence. A.S. Patterson, having been sworn, read, and other witnesses stated, said Amelia's testimony on the former trial, tending to show her marriage with the defendant. The defendant accepted to the admission of the evidence. Unquote. Let me reiterate what just happened there. The prosecution had someone read the text of a transcript of past testimony that Amelia Jane had previously been compelled to testify in an earlier indictment against her own husband. So even while not being in this particular trial as a subpoena-compelled witness, Amelia Jane's past under oath testimony was still used in place of her, against her husband. Reynolds' attorneys took exception to that use of that secondary testimony, forming the basis for this question number 4 being herewith addressed by the 1878 SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States. As cited from the decision, Chief Justice Waite wrote, quote, the Constitution gives the accused the right to a trial at which he should be confronted with the witnesses against him. But if a witness is absent by his own wrongful procurement, he cannot complain if competent evidence is admitted to supply the place of that which he has kept away. ... If, therefore, when absent by his procurement, their evidence is supplied in some lawful way, he is in no condition to assert that his constitutional rights have been violated. Unquote. Chief Justice Waite then went off into a long-winded self-justification by deferring to decisions from an ancient foreign court, a non-U.S. court, the foreign government of England, prior to the formation of the United States, way back to the year 1666. Quote, in Lord Morley's case, as long ago as the year 1666, it was resolved in the House of Lords. Unquote. Blah, blah, blah. The House of Lords? England? No way! It is genuinely difficult to stomach the very notion of denying U.S. constitutional rights via citing legal decisions of ancient and non-American sources. But that is what Chief Justice Waite did, as he deferred by saying that it, quote, seems to have been recognized as the law in England ever since, unquote. Again, England? Hello, this is the United States of America, not England. He continued, quote, the rule has its foundation in the maxim that no one shall be permitted to take advantage of his own wrong. .. A maxim based on the principles of common honesty and, if properly administered, can harm no one. Unquote. Honesty? No harm? Are you kidding me? Seriously, compelling a wife to testify against her own husband by force of law against her will is a harm. And it is wholly dishonest to suggest anything otherwise. Worse, using that past under oath testimony in this later trial is, in absolute fact, a continued harm against both the wife and the defendant husband. As further cited from the text, Chief Justice Waite wrote, quote, the testimony shows that the absent witness was the alleged second wife of the accused, that she had testified on a former trial for the same offense under another indictment, that she had no home except with the accused, that at some time before the trial, a subpoena had been issued for her, but by mistake, she was named as Mary Jane Scobold. .. At 10 o'clock that morning, the case was again called, and the foregoing facts being made to appear, the court ruled that evidence of what the witness had sworn to at the former trial was admissible. In this, we see no error. Unquote. Subsequently, Chief Justice Waite concluded, quote, upon the testimony as it stood, it is clear to our minds that the judgment should not be reversed because secondary evidence was admitted. Unquote. So there we have it, folks. A wife had been compelled to testify under oath against her own husband in an earlier indictment. Having learned from that tyranny, the family rightly did what any normal family would try to do in this next trial. Namely, the Reynolds family did whatever they could to help her not be compelled again to testify against her own husband. So, instead, the government exploited her past compelled testimony to still speak for her in her absence, thereby still continuing this as a matter of a wife horrifically forced against her will by government to testify against her own husband. And to justify this anti-constitutional tyranny, the 1878 Supreme Court self-justified this oppression by deferring to an ancient and foreign court. Truth is, constitutional rights are not privileges that may ever somehow be overridden on the basis of anything that happened in a foreign country, even if that country is England. So with that, now we have the response to the fourth of the six questions addressed by the 1878 Supreme Court in this case. In a future episode, or maybe even episodes, I will address the next question. Question number 5 of the SCOTUS decision, Reynolds v. United States of 1878. Oh, and one last thing. Before I end this here, did you notice how this is episode number 313 that first aired on March 13? No, I did not plan that at all. In the year of 2024, this episode number 313 was first aired on 313, March 13, 2024. Okay. Well, I thought it was fun to notice. It was an unplanned fact. I hope you might enjoy it too. Whether you do or not, that's okay. But either way, please stay tuned. And know that I thank you for celebrating, supporting, listening to, and sharing the National Polygamy Advocate Podcast.
Mark Henkel is National Polygamy Advocate, presented polygamy to the public since 1994. National Polygamy Advocate.com.